Hey there, it's Ashley here. Just to say, we're on to the fourth episode of Landmark, and although it hardly sounds epic, what we've found is that stories lead to stories, especially with a theme as wide as we've chosen. What navigates you to knowing who you are? Or as Chris Martin puts it, what lights guide you home? And often the landmarks are closer than you think. A couple of weeks ago, we were invited to a dhikr. Essentially, a dhikr is a litany of song sung in various harmonies as remembrance of who we are in the presence of something much bigger than ourselves. That dhikr was held in the home of a local headmaster in Boer Kaap. Rugs and sheets were placed on the lounge floor, and the group, including the imam, assembled for the singing. After about 2 hours of really powerful vocals and song, food was shared, and we all left walking on air. I'm sharing the behind the scenes here for two reasons. The harmonies you'll hear throughout this episode now were recorded that night. And this is just one instance of an event, a cultural marker that exists in my town that I never even knew about. It's life-affirming, and it's an example of a side of humanity that helps to navigate the world that we're in. Okay, that's it from me. Over to Fatima and the quest for a hero.
Because of the world we're in now and everything just being shoved down our throats and everything's being right now, right now, right now, right now, right now, we don't look back and we don't see what's happened and we don't study what happened and we're not taught what happened and we're not educated on history.
This week, we're on a kind of journey. A journey towards our human essence.
I mean, education in the past was always the classics.
To learn about who we are and where we are, we have to look at where we came from.
Any young man that went to a significant school learned Latin, ancient Greek, and studied the Iliad and the Odyssey and Greek tragedy and, you know, Tacitus and what happened in Rome and what happened in ancient Greece, what happened with Alexander the Great, because this was something that you could look back on as a kind of heroic grouping or a heroic time that you could take learning from to strive towards being better.
And this is what we want, right? To be better. To repattern our neural pathways to support our most authentic self.
Rather than what we find in the modern world, which is this kind of ideal future that we're kind of trying to run towards, but we're obviously never going
to
get there.
And to take us on this journey, we found Abdallah Dattin, a young, dynamic Muslim man based in Cape Town.
My podcast is In Search of a Muslim Hero. So what am I passionate about? Right now, my biggest passion is exploring heroism.
How does heroism manifest? And how does it manifest in different epochs and different times? And also how we as humans in the 21st century can unleash our heroic.
Landmark.
Land.
Culture.
Belonging.
Landmark.
Landmark is a six-part podcast series that explores some ideas about who we are and where we are and what it means to belong to this place called South Africa.
So what does that mean? How do we explore our heroic?
The key figure in the subject of heroism is Joseph Campbell. Now, he wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and that is the blueprint for every story that is written, spoken, turned into a screenplay, every movie. They all follow the same generic form. And it's something, you mentioned neural pathways. It's something that taps into the collective unconscious. And if you look at all all mythology and all the stories throughout history, whether that is the Iliad or the Odyssey coming from ancient Greece or the Gilgamesh from, you know, ancient Persia, or any kind of heroic story, or any story in general, really, they all follow the same path, and it's the hero's journey, where you have the protagonist going on this journey into the unknown, and in the unknown there's all of these obstacles that he has to overcome, he or she, and in overcoming the obstacles he gets closer to his their deeper knowledge of themselves, and then the hero either transcends it or is a victim of it.
So if we continue to identify with things that aren't really us, then something tragic happens. Do you have an example of this?
Oedipus is the kind of the great example of the tragic hero. Basically, at the end of it, he has to gore his eyes out, you know. This is quite tragic, yeah. But now what's interesting is that I want to say a remix, that's not the word. There's another version of the Oedipal myth written by Dr. Ian Dallas called Oedipus and Dionysus. And in that, Dr. Dallas gives another perspective on the Oedipal myth. And that is, if you have one eye looking inwards and one eye looking outwards, so you've got one eye looking at the rational and another that your other eye looking inwards at the irrational, and if you can go through life in that with that balance, then you can surpass it, and you can, instead of Oedipus being the tragic hero, he's able to transcend it, and he is able to it's not tragic. The ending is beautiful.
So these inward and outward eyes gives us knowledge of the self and our surroundings, increasing our consciousness. And Dr. Dallas is suggesting that this is the way to heroism. Would you say the inward gives us self-knowledge?
Yes, I guess it's a possibility. I mean, there's an artist called Max Ernst, who was one of the surrealist artists at the turn of last century. And there's a fascinating documentary on him on YouTube. And at the end of it, he says, "I'm so glad that I never found myself. Because if I had found myself, the art would have stopped." That's not verbatim, but that's the essence of it. And it's something that the lover of the great German poet Rilke, Lou Andres Salome, she also said a very similar thing to him. Because he was going through a bit of a whatever he was going through, and she wrote him a letter saying that along the lines of, stop trying to find yourself, just be. If you find yourself, the writing will stop.
Stop trying to find yourself, just be. This is fascinating, yeah. Sometimes we get lost in the healing when we need to be present to take in the moment for what it really is.
So again, I mean, you're talking about landmarks. It's all about the journey, isn't it? So it's the journey to yourself. It's the journey, and I mean, what we understand as Muslims is that knowledge of the self is knowledge of the divine. So when you fight, when you know who you are, then you can know who Allah or God or the divine or the universe or however you want to define it. Then you can know the divine.
Yeah, it's about learning who we really are at our core, the part of us that doesn't change. Our infinite, authentic self. And this brings us closer to the divine.
Islam is not about what you wear. It's not about how you look. It's about what's in your heart.
Yeah, definitely. It's about what's really going on in your heart. It's a way of life that promotes clear, pure intentions. And we believe actions are judged by the intentions fueling them. Okay. You said all this initial talk is warming us up for something.
I have to be very careful what I say here because I'm not South African. I moved here in 2006, So I didn't live through apartheid. I didn't see any of the horrors of apartheid. I've only heard of it, whether from people that experienced it directly. But there's one thing that I do want to talk about, and that is the idea of the nation state. Now, the traditional definition of a nation was, or is, a grouping of people with a shared geography, a shared language, a shared culture, and a shared, well, is a shared people. So I guess that would be defined as your kind of genetics. That's the definition of a nation. If you look at the map of Africa, if you look at the map of the Middle East, there are literally straight lines. That's not a natural divide. It's just not a natural divide. You know, it was purposely done as an act of division. And I think something that's very pertinent and very much in everyone's mindset at the moment is the thing is what, everything that's happening in Palestine. And again, I mean, the Palestinians as a people are the same tribes as in Syria and in Lebanon and, you know, Jordan. You know, it's just these countries have been divided up and cut up, and the natural people that were there have all been divided. Same thing in Turkey. Like, the north of Syria is Kurdish, half of Turkey is Kurdish, but Turkey is this country that now divides between the Kurds of Turkey and the Kurds of Syria. So it's like all of these kind of unnatural divisions have been made. I mean, and again, also the map of Africa, I mean, you see like some of these borders, like straight lines through the Sahara, and it's like, no, that doesn't make sense. So we defined a nation as a common people with a common language, with a common culture, and a common geography. So like a common area, like a common space. And when you look at South Africa, I mean, just officially, how many languages are there? 12? 14? 11. Okay, so there's 11 official languages. You know, right? And how many tribes are there? So to call South Africa a nation, you see, this is where I get a little bit contentious. I mean, look, okay, let me take a step back. Let me talk about the example of France. Now, Charles de Gaulle, who was the first president of the kind of new France, and a general in the First World War, a general in the Second World War, I think. He said, how can you govern a country that has 248 cheeses? Right. Now, they defined that as a witticism, as it's like, aha, funny, you know, like he's saying there's so many cheeses. But if you actually look into what he was saying, because don't forget, this is a military man. He sees the world strategically. So if he's saying that, how can you govern a nation with 248 cheeses, there's something in it more than just a joke. Now, if you look at the history of France, and you go back before the French Revolution, which is when the kind of modern world made a massive shift, you see that France had 22 different key languages, right? So there were, even within each one of those languages, there was a kind of different dialects of that language, but there were 22 key languages. Now, if you take a map of the different languages of France in, let's say, 1700, and you take a map and you put on top of that a map of the castles of France, and you take a third map of the cheeses of France, you see that they all align. It's absolutely fascinating. So you see that the knowledge of how to make that specific cheese came out of a unique nation with its own language and its own castles and its own governance, right? At the time of the French Revolution, only half of France could understand French. And by 1850 something, only a quarter of France spoke French, like what we know as French, as their native tongue. You see that France was made up of a whole load of different nations. So when Charles de Gaulle said, how can you govern a nation that has 248 cheeses. He's saying, how can you govern a nation that has all of these? How can you govern a so-called country that has all these different nations within it? Now, if you take that into the South African context, how many nations are there here? You've got the Afrikaner are a nation, the Sotho are a nation, the Zulu are a nation. You know, you keep going, the Ndebele are a nation, and the Ndebele are a nation that are, again, cut between Zimbabwe and South Africa because of somebody drawing a line. So, for me, the modern state is basically an artificial creation to herd people into what they call a nation state solely for the purpose of tax. And on top of that is divide and conquer. Divide the people that you can manipulate and take control. And it's something that, I mean, whether you want to say that that came from colonialism or whether that came from the rise of the technological state post Second World War, or however you want to look at it, there's different angles.
You're saying that according to your definition of a nation, South Africa has multiple nations within it. And we're trying to function as one nation, but this is dividing us further. So how do you fit? How do you belong?
Well, first of all, how do I fit? How do I belong? Is something that is very relevant to me because my father is white British and my mother is Pakistani Indian British. So from the get-go, from the moment I popped out, there's been two dynamics in my life. Going to my father's mother's house, and I'd sit there at table with a knife and fork, back up straight, you know, don't speak with your mouth full, elbows off the table, etc., etc. And that was how I ate at my my paternal grandparents' house. Then on my maternal grandparents' house, from a Pakistani family, you know, it was a big plate of food on the floor, and everyone, you know, it's like among the kids, it was like a ruckus, you know, a free-for-all, who can get the bone marrow first, you know, it was a full-on fight. But it was, you know, and it was lovely, but it was very different, you know, you're eating on the floor with a big plate of food and everyone shouting and making lots of noise, And I never felt like I wasn't one or I wasn't the other. I mean, again, coming back to my experience at school, I went to a kind of top-notch boarding school in Scotland. And I think when I started the school, I was the only Muslim in the school. I was the only brown kid. And I mean, I'm not even completely brown. You know, my father's white. And I was like the only brown kid at school. So, but again, I didn't feel like I didn't fit in. It was like, I was just, yeah, I'm also white, I'm also brown. But it just didn't matter. It never mattered to me. I've always been both. And, you know, I think that's something that when I came to South Africa, one of the key reasons why I just loved it so much was because I could be, like, I could maneuver with anybody, you know. I define myself as a chameleon. Like if I was with the Afrikaners, I mean, and I had a lot of, there was a part of my life where I was selling military equipment and stuff throughout Africa, and all my mechanics were Afrikaners, you know, and I could get on with them like a house on fire. And then you go to Rylands or something and you're there with the Indians and you know, I get on with them, it's perfectly fine. I speak to them like an Indian, and with Pakistanis, I'm Pakistani, and with the Malays or whatever, you know, I'm Malay. And I've always managed to be a bit of a shapeshifter, for good or for bad.
You can find belonging in many places because you're not pinned to one particular nation or identity. Identifying does seem to be key over here. In practices like Islam and yoga, we have tools that tune us into the divine and our true nature. And when we do this, it's meant to bring us peace.
All of these kind of so-called like mystic practices are all very much in tune with the fitrah, whether you look at that from an Islamic perspective, whether you look at that from a kind of yogic perspective, whether you look at that from a shamanic perspective, or whatever, the ancient rituals of the native Indians in America, they all come back to the same thing, and it's knowing yourself. And knowing yourself is knowing the divine. And knowing the divine is knowing that higher force that is there. You know, and you can find that in whichever way resonates with you, whether that's with the plants or whether that's with the animals or whether that's with the air, the fire, the earth, the land, the sea, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm just thinking now of the example of that the documentary that just won, what's it called? The Octopus Teacher. So that man, obviously, you know, it's in the ocean. And in our current world, we're so removed from it, in the sense of being in this urban environment, in this kind of created synthetic environment that has become even more removed from nature with the kind of advances in technology. It's almost like just being able to reconnect with your fitra is already a huge act of heroism in this time. On an individual level, it's that simple. It's just like reconnect with your fitra, reconnect with nature, look at the flowers. I mean, while we're sitting here, I keep seeing like the bees, you know, popping in and taking their thing. It's just observe that and just and appreciate it and love it and eat their honey. As opposed to sitting on your phone and scrolling through Instagram for hours on end, you know, as opposed to sitting on a computer screen, as opposed to watching TV, as opposed to, you know, and I'm not saying don't watch TV, I'm not saying don't go on Instagram, I'm not saying that, I'm just saying that, like, make space and make time for yourself just to appreciate these things, because, you know, they are alive, and it's a connection to our own living.
Yeah, sure, like, I agree that advances in technology have removed us or made us less aware of nature. So what do you suggest we do from here?
One has to look back through history to see where we are today. And in the context of the nation state, you have to look back through history and you have to see what has happened with the rise of rationalism. You have to see what happened with the French Revolution, you know, and the destruction of the ancient regime. And you have to look at the Boer War with the accumulation of gold and the accumulation and storage of gold and diamonds. It happened. It was something that happened. You have to look at the First World War, which was a massive massacre, you know, and it was a massacre that destroyed the elite of society. Every young man that was from a prominent family that had honor and had a yearning to fight for his country was basically killed or injured and destroyed. And if they weren't killed, they were psychologically destroyed by what they were seeing around them. You know, it was a horrific event. And who was financing it? Where was the money coming from? It was the same people financing both sides. And so with the First World War, you have the annihilation of a generation of people. And with the Second World War, it's like the final nail in the coffin, where now you've got the rise of the technological warfare with machine guns and planes and, you know, these warships and just... I mean, if the First World War was a massacre, the Second World War was a flipping... I don't even know how you would describe it. It was just apocalypse. It was just mowing down people, both soldiers and civilians, you know. And what comes out of the Second World War is the rise of the new power structure. And what comes out of the Second World War is the division of all of these nations that are, like I mentioned before, drawn on a map with a ruler.
By new power structure, I assume you mean the banking class and multinational corporations. And yeah, nations were strategically divided by the colonizers, just lines on paper. Go on.
Because of the world we're in now and everything just being shoved down our throats and everything's being right now, right now, right now, right now, right now, we don't look back and we don't see what's happened and we don't study what happened and we're not taught what happened and we're not educated on history. I mean, education in the past was always the classics. That any young man that went to a significant school learned Latin, ancient Greek, and studied the Iliad and the Odyssey and Greek tragedy and, you know, what Tacitus and what happened in Rome and what happened in ancient Greece, what happened with Alexander the Great, because there was, this was something that you could look back on as a kind of heroic grouping or a heroic time that you could take learning from to strive towards being better, rather than what we find in the modern world, which is this kind of ideal future that we're kind of trying to run towards, but we're obviously never going to get there. Whether that's flying, going off to live on Mars with Elon Musk and his madness, or you know, this kind of ideal democracy that needs to be given to the entire world, which is just a complete lie.
Okay, so you're saying that we should educate ourselves on history and classical literature to find heroes and heroic times where there's rich culture, and this can inspire us to be better individuals and as a collective. What we also find if we look at peaceful societies rich in culture is human beings in a state of remembrance. Remembrance of who we truly are and why we're here. Instead of constantly imagining an idealistic future, we need to be in the present moment to truly live. It's through living in the moment that we discover our fitra.
As you get more people going back to their fitra, going back to their essence, going back to their authentic selves and being authentic and being true to themselves, they will see that in each other and they will come together. And from their coming together, naturally people will emerge who have the characteristics of leadership. And they will lead not because they are almost taking it, but because the others see in them that. And so that grouping of heroes, the grouping of heroic people, will raise up the hero that has those qualities of leadership, and from that will spur the next cycle in healthy and beneficial society for humans.
So after Abdallah's interview, I really got to thinking, what gets me connected to my fitra? Where do I feel my true essence and 100% it's being in nature? Getting out onto the mountain, on the beach, in the forest, wherever, at peace with the animals and the plants. It's just so relaxing. I can hear my heart and feel my fitra. That's it from me for now. Fatima Waleday. See you next time.